delegates. But the only noted black abolitionist was Martin Delaney, then living in Canada. The whites were primarily members of Brown's Kansas Band of Soldiers. Notably, neither Douglas nor any of the New England backers of Brown's crusade attended. Philosophizing about the nature of slavery and how it poisoned American institutions was one thing. Fomenting an abolitionist revolution and creating a government in the midst of a slave state were quite another. Douglas described Brown as obsessed with his Constitution during the winter days in Rochester. "It was the first thing in the morning and the last thing at night," Douglas recalled. "Till I confess, it began to be something of a bore to me." This remarkable comment reflected Douglas's response to the bizarre character of the Constitution, and an admission that Brown's personality, as well as his combination of zeal and lack of clarity, could wear down a busy, discerning person such as Douglas. The autobiographer remembered the old man mentioning the possibility of attacking the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry to seize weapons. Douglas soon realized the gravity of such a turn in the warrior's vision. Brown asked Douglas to put out two planed boards on which Brown diagrammed forts and secret passages in the mountains where he would stage his revolution. Douglas began to listen with caution. He admitted that he was less interested in the drawings and board gaming than his children were. Brown even used a set of blocks to illustrate his plans to the assembled children, who surely never forgot those wintry evenings. What Anna Douglas thought of this austere man with a long white beard whom she was feeding each day is not known. On February 4th, he wrote to his eldest son that Douglas had promised him $50, but "what I value vastly more, he seems to appreciate my theories and my labors." Perhaps, but Douglas's wry remembrances of those theories, as well as his actions, remind us of the most basic fact in this union of awkward allies. As long as Brown bravely advanced the idea of funneling fugitive slaves out of the Upper South, and thereby politically threatened the slave system generally, Douglas was on board, despite the risks. But when assaulting a large U.S. arsenal emerged in the scheme, the writer parted ways with the warrior. Douglas also performed as a conduit, even a kind of banker for Brown, with other black leaders. They sent modest drafts of money to Rochester for the editor to pass on to the revolutionary. In mid-March, in Philadelphia, Brown and John Jr. met with Douglas, Henry Highland Garnett, and the famed Underground Railroad activist, William Still. They gathered at the home of Stephen Smith, a successful black lumber dealer and protector of runaway slaves in that city. What Brown or Douglas might have divulged about invasion or insurrectionary plans is not known. These and other meetings like them were essentially to prime the pump of a constant fundraising campaign. But through most of 1857 to 58, Brown's clandestine enterprise was broke. He established a training base in Tabor, Iowa, for his diminishing band of men. He then squandered an exorbitant amount of money hiring a soldier of fortune, Hugh Forbes, an English fencing teacher Brown had met in New York City, who had fought in the Italian Revolution with Giuseppe Garibaldi, and promised to write a training manual and serve as the drill instructor. Unfortunately, Forbes was a scoundrel who sought to enrich himself off New England humanitarians as he betrayed the invasion plan to high American officials when he did not receive his promised compensation. In late March 1858, Brown paid a 10-day visit to his home, his wife Mary, and their small children in North Elba, New York. This may have been a kind of leave-taking, since he plans to launch the Virginia adventure later that spring or early summer. Surely, Brown sought emotional solace in what was left of his devastated family. Six of Brown's sons and one son-in-law had fought in Kansas. By that spring, one was dead, two badly wounded, and two others had undergone imprisonment, torture, and severe mental breakdowns. In letters Brown wrote from his retreat at Douglas's home in February, he had counseled Mary and the family, "Courage, courage, courage. The great work of my life, the unseen hand that guided me, and who has indeed holden my right hand, may hold it still, I may yet see accomplished. Kansas, and ultimately Harper's Ferry, were a gruesome disaster that Brown brought upon his own family. In the face of such poverty and loss, he, not to mention his wife and surviving children, needed a profound faith in that helping hand. On April 4th, Brown once again arrived in Rochester, where he spent a night with Douglas. Accompanied by the former fugitive slave, Jermaine Logan, and still preparing and recruiting for his convention in Chatham the next month, he then traveled to St. Catharines, Canada, to visit and try to enlist Harriet Tubman in his cause. The legendary Tubman, with her years of experience rescuing slaves in Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware, now lived in St. Catharines. Although she encouraged and advised Brown and left the old man in awe, she never made any promises to join him. If he could muster enough men, money, and guns, Brown had planned to launch his raid in 1858, soon after the Chatham gathering. But the knave, Hugh Forbes, claiming lack of payment, informed three U.S. senators, as well as the editor of the New York Tribune, Horace Greeley, of the operation. The entire scheme was therefore postponed for at least a year. Although Douglas met with and paid the hotel bill for Forbes when he visited Rochester seeking personal funds in late 1857, the editor exaggerated his own role in exposing the Englishman's betrayals to Brown, claiming to have first broken the news. Douglas had embarrassing tracks to cover on this count. Through his friend, Odely Ossing, he had introduced Forbes to a series of New York acquaintances as potential donors, all of which only added to the danger of blown secrecy. The Forbes postponement, as participants and scholars came to call it, forced Brown to return to Kansas and lie relatively low until 1859. The 58-year-old, with the flowing white Moses-like beard, fell ill for weeks with malarial fevers. He chose yet another new alias, Shubal Morgan, the first name meaning captive of God. Hatred and violence over the slavery question still roiled in Kansas. In December 1858, a slave named Jim Daniels crossed over from Missouri, found Brown, and summoned his assistance in protecting him and his young family from their owner, who intended to sell them away southward. Physically recovered, Brown strapped on his guns and led 18 guerrillas into Missouri. They liberated Daniels's family, as well as one other group of slaves from two farms, resulting in the death of one slaveholder, and spirited the 11 rescued people back into Kansas. Here, finally, Brown had liberated slaves from under the noses of their owners. Then what ensued was possibly the most heroic and admirable feat of Brown's troubled career. After hiding in makeshift quarters and among anti-slavery settlers in Kansas for a month, Brown led an epic 82-day, 1,000-mile midwinter trek on foot and horseback, as well as with an oxen-driven wagon, across Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, and Michigan. With the aid especially of abolitionist activists in Grinnell, Iowa, Brown and his liberated entourage eventually rode in a special boxcar by train to Chicago and on to Detroit. On a blustery March 12, 1859, Brown bid a tearful farewell to the now 12 liberated blacks as they were spirited to freedom across the Detroit River at Windsor, Ontario. Back in Kansas, Jim Daniels' wife had given birth to a baby boy christened John Brown Daniels. When Brown's daughter, Ruth, asked him later about his feelings during that scene on the Detroit River, her father merely answered with scripture, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation." That night in Detroit, Brown returned to earthly matters as he met with Douglas, who was on an extended Western speaking tour. Brown had written ahead when he heard of Douglas's presence and urged him to wait for a rendezvous. Douglas heard Brown's latest plans among a group of black Detroiters led by George DeBaptiste, the militant leader of that city's Colored Vigilance Committee, which worked to direct fugitive slaves into Canada. Despite the success of the Missouri rescue, Douglas had gone cold on Brown's scheme, especially if it included Harper's Ferry. The old man's heroic image was now thoroughly compelling. He was the revolutionary that abolitionists such as Douglas had yearned for. Or was he? That winter, during the rescue journey, Douglas's daughter Rosetta wrote to her father, demonstrating how the warrior had become an intimate part of their family lore. "Old Brown will have to keep out of sight for a while. The governor of Missouri has a reward of $3,000 offered for his capture." In Brown's travels eastward in mid-April for more money raising, he stopped by Douglas's printing office for an afternoon to make yet another appeal to the most famous black activist. Brown believed, dubiously, that Douglas's presence would attract other courageous blacks to the cause of violent action. Douglas provided a serious conversation, but no promises. He reported in his paper, though, very publicly, that a hero, Old Brown of Kansas memory, had just visited Rochester and made an appearance to speak at City Hall. His host was angry at local Republicans for their disappointing or cowardly turnout. Later that summer, Brown rented a farmhouse, the Kennedy Farm, in western Maryland, a mere 5 miles north of Harper's Ferry, as his secret staging base for the attack on the federal arsenal across the Virginia border. Douglas was certainly informed of the location and now of its purpose. He and Brown kept up correspondence through that fateful summer, and on August 10th, Douglas met with John Brown Jr. in Rochester. Soon after that encounter, the editor answered the old man's summons to come meet him in a stone quarry near Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, just across from the Maryland line. Douglas recorded a detailed recollection of this fateful final meeting between the two men. In autobiographical time, Douglas could control the narrative. But in real time, on August 19th and 20th, when he met the revolutionary, who was disguised as a fisherman and camped among bleak large stones, an agonized emotional tension enveloped their friendship. Douglas brought a $20 contribution given him on a stop in New York City by a black couple, the Reverend James Glochester and his wife, as well as one significant recruit, a fugitive slave named Shields Green, who had escaped from slavery in Charleston, South Carolina. Green was a man of few words, but steel nerves, and had met Brown on one of his visits to Douglas in Rochester. As Douglas arrived in Chambersburg, a town with a sizable free black population, he was immediately recognized and asked to deliver a speech. Not wishing to blow his cover, he responded, as asked, in a local black church. Then for 2 days, Brown and Douglas, along with John Coggy, one of Brown's most trusted aides-de-camp, with Green present as well, debated the Harper's Ferry scheme. Douglas did not exaggerate when he remembered feeling that he was on a dangerous mission. Indeed, at the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah rivers, and only 65 miles from Washington, D.C., the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry housed the largest stash of munitions in the United States. Brown begged Douglas to join him for the raid, as Douglas listened but resisted, and then vehemently strove to dissuade the old man from the attack. Brown looked bedraggled, storm-beaten, his clothing about the color of the stone quarry itself. But the final realization of his imminent invasion of Virginia put fire in the old man's eyes. Possibly, Douglas still did not know fully of the intent to attack the arsenal until he arrived in Chambersburg, although he had heard it hinted at several times before. That Douglas made such an extremely risky trip to southern Pennsylvania at this late date may indicate that he knew a great deal, but perhaps not quite enough. It also reflected a kind of desperate loyalty he had always demonstrated toward Brown, showing up with money and a recruit, the two things the warrior had always sought. Still, gravely in search of that logic of violence that he could embrace in the mind, not merely the heart, Douglas stepped away from Brown's bleak, death-defying heroism. The writer-orator looked reality in the face and said a resounding no. At age 41, Douglas was not prepared to die in such futility. Douglas told Brown that the raid would prove fatal to all earlier plans for running off slaves and the creation in the mountains of a militarized underground railroad, the one aspect of Brown's schemes that attracted Douglas. Brown threw his arms around Douglas at their campfire and begged him to lend his life and reputation to the cause. "Come with me, Douglas," Brown pled. "I will defend you with my life. I want you for a special purpose. When I strike, the bees will begin to swarm, and I shall want you to help hive them." But the former slave knew far too much about the instinctive suspicions of slaves toward their would-be liberators, as well as about the bloodshed surely to follow any slave insurrection. Above all, Douglas looked Brown in the eye and told him that, despite his apparent aim of rousing the nation, he was attacking the federal government, which would marshal all its military might against him. He was going into a perfect steel trap, Douglas told Brown in no uncertain terms, and warned that Virginia would blow him and his hostages sky high rather than that he should hold Harper's Ferry an hour. The conversation deteriorated into a grim, if noble, despair. Douglas knew he had encountered a tragedy he could not stop. He let Shields Green make his own choice, and the young man's response was simple. "I believe I'll go with the old man." Green would be captured at Harper's Ferry, along with Brown, and hanged on December 16th, 2 weeks after the old man. His body was given for dissection to a Virginia medical school. Autobiography allows for an ordering of time and motives. In the clear-minded moment of August 20th, 1859, Douglas made one of the great rational decisions of his life. Soon, though, the man who had expended so much rhetoric advocating violence in the 1850s would have to explain himself as an exile in a doubting world. In the first 9 months of 1859, before Harper's Ferry changed everything, Douglas had hardly sat on his hands waiting for Brown to strike his blows. From February 1st to March 12th, Douglas launched one of his exhausting lecture tours across the Midwest in the states of Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. He delivered some 50 speeches in 6 weeks. Douglas encountered no mobs and only a little hostility. He was viciously Jim Crowed in a hotel in Janesville, Wisconsin. He found the tour debilitating but soul-cheering. As a black voice, he served as an excellent thermometer of the political climate. The slavery question seemed uppermost in everyone's mind among his huge audiences that spring. In the heartland, where the Republican Party found its deepest allegiances, Douglas kept up steady criticism of the party's moderate policies, especially its tendency to support exclusion laws, to deny settlement by blacks in Western territories. He attacked Republicans' free soilism as never enough, calling it an inconsistent, vacillating, crooked, and compromising advocacy of a good cause. During his absence from the Douglas's Monthly, the name was newly changed, he gave over the editor's chair to McCune Smith, who dazzled the paper's readers with essays on black education, self-reliance, suffrage, and politics. The Order might have also given himself over to full-time lecturing for a while as a fundraiser. He repeatedly appealed to his subscribers to pay up and keep his paper afloat. While John Brown plotted, Douglas kept up a steady and fierce debate with fellow black leaders such as Henry Highland Garnet over emigration schemes. Douglas respected Garnet and the right to emigrate, but attacked the idea of willful African-American removal from the United States. Douglas loathed the notion that some of the best black leaders would abandon the American ship at this pivotal hour in history. Garnet's mission was to extend civilization and Christianity to the heathen of Africa and to end slave trading. But Douglas, who referred to West African rulers who sold slaves as savage, angrily insisted that American slaves must be freed first. In January 1859, Garnet and Douglas exchanged honest missives, disagreeing vehemently. Garnet accused his dear brother of enjoying the comforts of the editorial chair rather than venturing to Africa to make a new civilization for their people. Garnet even accused the editor of a toil-fearing spirit. Douglas reacted with grace, but firmly condemned, once again, all forms of colonization as false prophecy and a historical dead end. Although he sometimes expressed modest interest in possible migrations to Haiti, to Douglas, removal, even in the wake of Dred Scott, only fueled the idea that black people could never be equal in America. The best way to defeat racism, said the editor, was to stop with wandering eyes and open mouths, looking out for some mighty revolution in our affairs here, which is to remove us from this country. Douglas and Garnet wanted different revolutions. You go there. We stay here. It's just the difference between us, Douglas told the minister. Douglas sustained as well his radical critique of Republicans, demanding that abolitionists return to your principles and reject appeals on behalf of free white labor. Energized by the public lectern, throughout 1859, Douglas kept up his drumbeat against racial segregation and about uses of force. With special urgency, by summer he blasted the limits of Republican non-extension, calling the slave system a fiery dragon sweeping across the South. While the monster lives, Douglas characteristically declared, he will hunger and thirst, breathe and expand. The true way is to put the knife into its quivering heart. Rhetorically, Douglas had long been ready for violence. Among the final editorials Douglas wrote before Harper's Ferry was one entitled The Ballot and the Bullet. The piece is a measure of Douglas's frustrations as well as his passions. Reacting ostensibly to a Garrisonian challenge that abolitionists should employ only the sword of the spirit and abandon all appeals to the ballot or the bullet, Douglas reflexively declared such a debate nonsense. Hearts and consciences were crucial, he admitted. But truth, to be efficient, must be uttered in action as well as in speech. If speech could end slavery, Douglas said, it would have been done long ago. He demanded an anti-slavery government, but the political system seemed to offer only can't, and he was sick of it. Hence, the ballot is needed, and if this will not be heard and heeded, then the bullet. Law was necessary, but so was physical force. As an exclamation point on the bankruptcy of moral suasion, Douglas also unwittingly exhibited that an expectation, even a justification, for violence could leave a gaping, unbearable chasm between words and actions. When news broke about the raid on Harper's Ferry on October 17th and 18th, Douglas was in Philadelphia, where he gave a speech at National Hall. Late on the night of October 16th, Brown and his 18 men had seized the arsenal. Within 36 hours, the raid was over. 10 of Brown's men were killed in the raid, some captured, including the badly wounded Brown himself. While 5 escaped, 3 of whom would die fighting in the Civil War, the captives were hanged in the coming months by the state of Virginia. 3 slaves temporarily liberated by Brown's band died in the raid or its aftermath. 5 town residents or workers, including the Harper's Ferry mayor, were killed, and 9 militiamen or U.S. Marines were wounded in the day of street battles. The raid was a strategic disaster, yet with time emerged as the most catalytic and successful symbolic event in the history of the anti-slavery cause. Newspapers screamed with shocking and confused headlines, such as the litany on the cover of the New York Herald for October 18th. Fearful and exciting intelligence. Extensive Negro conspiracy. Seizure of United States arsenal by the insurrectionists. Within a day of Brown's capture and arrest, Douglas's name appeared in the newspapers across the country as one of the conspirators identified in a large collection of papers confiscated from a trunk left at the Kennedy farm in Maryland. Wild rumors mixed with some facts, as many newspapers gave over their entire sheets for days to telegraphic reports about Harper's Ferry. By October 29th, Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper began its extraordinary pictorial coverage of Brown, the raid, the trials, and the executions, giving the country a feast of images well into 1860. There had never been an event like this in American history. Douglas recalled it as news with the startling effect of an earthquake, something to make the boldest hold his breath. Douglas quickly realized he was in dire trouble. He delivered his Philadelphia lecture in which he openly referred to Brown's raid approvingly. But soon afterward, he was informed by friends that John Hearn, the city's sympathetic anti-slavery telegraph operator, had received a dispatch from government authorities to the local sheriff ordering that Douglas be arrested and detained as a conspirator. Hearn delayed its delivery for 3 hours, as long as friends agreed to get Mr. Douglas out of the state. Hearn became a prominent photographer, and Douglas sat no fewer than 8 times for him in the 1860s and 1870s, a measure of the bond the two men developed. Douglas swiftly departed from the Walnut Street Wharf over to Camden, New Jersey, a route he remembered well from his escape to freedom in 1838. Now he was a fugitive again, of another kind. Hurrying northward, he took the train to New York, and late on the night of October 19th, he caught the ferry to Hoboken, to the home of Mrs. Marks, where Odalie Ossing lived as a boarder. There, Douglas spent the night as he made a risky decision to use the railroads to continue his flight home to Rochester. Worried about sundry letters and a constitution written by John Brown locked in his desk in Rochester, he dictated a telegram to Ossing to be sent the next morning to Douglas's eldest son, Louis. Addressed to the telegraph operator in Rochester, whom the editor knew well, it read, B.F. Blackall, Esquire. Tell Louis, my oldest son, to secure all the important papers in my high desk. To keep secrecy, he did not sign his name. In the Life and Times reminiscence, Douglas observed that in the 1880s, the mark of the chisel still remained on the old desk where Louis had pried it open, one of the family traces of the John Brown raid. Both John Hearn and Ossing eventually staked claims to having saved Douglas's life. On October 20th, Ossing and another neighbor took Douglas in the dark of night in a private carriage to Paterson, New Jersey, so that he could take the Erie Railroad to Rochester, not the train he might normally be expected to occupy. He arrived safely, but immediately was informed by his neighbor, Samuel Porter, that the New York lieutenant governor was prepared to arrest Douglas if Governor Henry Wise of Virginia, now in charge of the investigation, issued such an order. Indeed, Wise was especially determined to capture Douglas, who eventually reprinted the Virginia governor's remarkable letter to President James Buchanan, requesting his assistance in finding and apprehending the person of Frederick Douglas, a Negro man charged with murder, robbery, and inciting servile insurrection. In emotional desperation, with hardly time for a serious reckoning with Anna and his children, Douglas packed a bag, and by what was likely October 22nd, Amy and Isaac Post drove him to the docks and a ferry across Lake Ontario into Canada. It was widely reported that Douglas escaped from Rochester a mere 6 hours before federal marshals arrived at his home, seeking his arrest. Anna's despair and his children's fears can only be imagined. They had by then lost count of the times when they felt abandoned by their beloved husband and father. But this time, it may have felt as if their world had ended. The countless earlier appeals for the blood of slaveholders had found an astounding result fraught with horrible uncertainty. In Canada, Douglas first stayed in a tavern in Clifton, which is today Niagara Falls. He was due west of Rochester, although soon it became clear that he could not go home anytime soon. Not only was Henry Wise searching for him, but he soon learned of severe criticism from one of Brown's captured men, John Cook, as well as from some black leaders, claiming that the abolitionist had promised to join the raid and betrayed the cause. Douglas may have let the sound and awe of the falls soothe his psyche. He certainly did not fall on his sword with guilt and affliction, although the accusations put him painfully on the defensive. On October 27th, he wrote to Amy Post in Rochester, implying that he would return to the New York side of the border soon, admitting, however, that it will take many months to blow this heavy cloud from my sky. He hated his current exile and worried about the possible confiscation of his property if his indictment held. But he whistled with false confidence, "It cannot be lost unless I am convicted. I cannot be convicted if I am not tried. I cannot be arrested unless caught. I cannot be caught if I keep out of the way. And just this thing, it is my purpose to do." On October 31st, Douglas responded the only way he could, with his pen, in a public letter to a Rochester newspaper that was in turn reprinted all over the country. To Cook's jailhouse accusation of cowardice against him, Douglas first blamed the hothouse of terror-stricken slaveholders surrounding the sensational situation in Virginia. Then, with a degree of comic irony he may have regretted, he answered the personal charge. "I have not one word to say in defense or vindication of my character for courage. I have always been more distinguished for running than fighting, and tried by the Harper's Ferry insurrection test, I am most miserably deficient in courage." Soon, he would have to endure an extraordinary cartoon that appeared in Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper, depicting Douglas leaping through the air in sheer fright with a trunk on his shoulder, his shoes and hat flying off. To his side is the small signpost to Canada. The title reads, "The Way in Which Fred Douglas Fights Wise of Virginia." And the caption below, "I have always been more distinguished for running than fighting." Douglas unequivocally denied ever promising to join Brown's band at Harper's Ferry. Whether from wisdom or cowardice, Douglas said, his field of labor for the abolition of slavery has not extended to an attack upon the United States arsenal. He did not fear being made an accomplice in the general conspiracy against slavery. Then he succinctly stated his long-term dilemma with violence. "I am ever ready to write, speak, publish, organize, combine, and even to conspire against slavery when there is a reasonable hope for success." Such had been the gaping hole in his quest for the logic of violence, as in the earlier Chambersburg moment of truth. As to why he had not joined Brown in Virginia, Douglas gave an honest answer: "The tools to those that can use them." There was a time for every purpose, for the war makers and for the war propagandists. Douglas knew his tools. Also, while sitting in Clifton, Canada, and reading wire dispatches and newspapers, Douglas followed Brown's celebrated trial in Charlestown, Virginia, which began on October 25th. He penned an extraordinary column for his paper, "Captain John Brown, Not Insane," which was not only a vintage, sharp-edged piece of abolitionism, but also Douglas's earliest effort to help build the majestic cross of John Brown's martyrdom. To allow a charge of insanity for Brown soiled this glorious martyr of liberty. Had Americans forgotten their own heroic age? Douglas wondered, as he quickly marched Brown into line next to the heroes of Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill. Brown was already Gideon of self-forgetful heroism. All the bad strategy and exasperatingly mysterious plans evaporated in the preparation for the gallows. John Brown had never made it easy to love him, until he found what one scholar has called his creative vocation of seeking martyrdom. Within 2 weeks of his capture, the bearded, prophet-like hero had suddenly offered the nation a new history. Douglas was already writing a first chapter, almost a prose equivalent of the song John Brown's Body. This age is too gross and sensual to appreciate his deeds, and so calls him mad, Douglas wrote. But the future will write his epitaph upon the hearts of a people freed from slavery, because he struck the first effectual blow. Douglas realized in mythic terms his logic of violence. Brown had used the weapons precisely adapted to destroy slavery. As poems, songs, and editorials flowed forth in American and European journals, Douglas made his own mark. "Like Samson," said a lonely Douglas in Canada, "Brown has laid his hands upon the pillars of this great national temple of cruelty and blood, and when he falls, the temple will speedily crumble to its final doom. Brown would have loved the metaphor, since Samson was one of his own oft-repeated self-comparisons. "I expect to effect a mighty conquest," Brown had written with customary grandiosity in 1858, "even though it will be like the last victory of Samson." Douglas and Brown could both claim old biblical stories that each man had expected their America to reenact. In the second week of November, Douglas passed through Toronto, took a steamer across Lake Ontario, and down the St. Lawrence River to Quebec, where on the 12th he departed on the ship Nova Scotia for Liverpool. He feared, as he remembered many years later, that he was going into exile, perhaps for life. On the bitterly cold decks of a ship in the North Atlantic, Douglas felt deeply troubled. In two sittings aboard the ship on its 10-day voyage to Liverpool, the lonely exile crafted a long letter. He amused himself and settled his nerves with comments on the Frenchness of Montreal, the majesties of the ocean, and the sturdiness of the steamer. "My head is hardly less confused than the waves," he admitted, "and my hand not more steady than the ship." As John Brown eagerly charted his plan to die from his jail cell in Virginia, Douglas now had to plot a plan to live. Chapter 16. Secession, taught by events. "I am for a dissolution of the Union. Decidedly for a dissolution of the Union. Under an abolition president who would wield the army and the navy of the government for the abolition of slavery, I should be for the union of these states." Frederick Douglass, Boston, December 1860. Among the most driving compulsions of Frederick Douglass's public life was his quest to alter, shape, or change history. He craved those moments and opportunities to gain access to real political power, to bend wills, and to be a creator of events and not merely their interpreter. Over and again, he learned the limits and frustrations of such a quest. During the Civil War era, Douglass spent great energy trying to discern and then affect what he frequently called the stern logic of events. In Life and Times, he reflected poignantly on how, during America's final road to disunion in 1859-61, he had done all in his power to convince his readers and listeners that the fate of the country depended on the liberation of the slave. From the safety of retrospect, Douglass expressed a certain hard-won wisdom about the nature of history. "In every way possible, in the columns of my paper and on the platform, by letters to friends at home and abroad, I did all that I could to impress this conviction upon the country. But nations seldom listen to advice from individuals, however reasonable. They are taught less by theories than by facts and events." John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, as well as the election of 1860 and the secession crisis that flowed in its wake, were just such seismic breaks in time when people were taught by events. Douglass could only react to and flee from the John Brown revolutionary moment. With time, however, he had a great deal to say about its political, moral, and religious meanings. Harper's Ferry became one of the markers of his life story. 10 months before the raid, in January 1859, with palpable despair, Douglass had yearned for hope and a historical clarity he could not find. "Would that this might prove the year of the Jubilee to those now toiling millions," he proclaimed in his paper. "Would that this were the day of release. But no wavering shadow of this coming event falls upon our vision. We walk by faith, not by sight." Bleakly, Douglass admitted that his well was dry. "How long? How long? O Lord God of Sabbath, shall the crushed and bleeding bondsman wait? Oh, who can answer? Who can tell the end we long to know?" But exactly a year later, Douglass was living in exile in Halifax, England, in northwest Yorkshire, at the home of his old friend Julia Griffiths Crofts and her husband, the Reverend Dr. Henry O. Crofts. On December 19th, the New York Times reported Douglas safely in England, where he defended John Brown and the raid. "John Brown has not failed," said the new exile. "He has dropped an idea equal to 1,000 bombshells into the very Bastille of slavery. That idea will live and grow, and one day will, unless slavery is otherwise abolished, cover Virginia with sorrow and blood." By then, Douglas must have read Brown's pre-gallows dark eloquence about a land purged with blood. By January 1860, the orator was once again back on the British anti-slavery speaking circuit, delivering tributes to Brown and historical lectures on the slavery issue in America. At Bradford on January 6th, an upbeat Douglas argued that American abolitionism had undergone continual progress since the first campaign of James Birney as the Liberty Party candidate for president in 1840. Now some 17 northern states had become politically anti-slavery, and John Brown's raid had enhanced the cause like nothing before. In his speeches during a six-month exile, he appropriated Brown's raid to a new variation of a prophetic tradition Douglas had long practiced. At Edinburgh, Scotland, on January 30th, Douglas used Brown's story to entertain as well as instruct his audience, garnering loud and prolonged cheering with the argument that American slaveholders were the real insurrectionists. The huge Queen Street Hall crowd thrilled to Douglas's radical interpretation of Harper's Ferry. The 350,000 slaveholders, with the American government so-called at their back, were but an armed band of insurgents against the just rights and liberties of their fellow men. John Brown merely stepped in to interrupt and arrest this insurrection against the rights and liberties of mankind, and he did right. The next night in Glasgow, at a reception in his honor in the City Hall, Douglas heard loud applause as he delivered a similar speech in which Isaiah's "No Peace to the Wicked" formed his theme. He garnered laughs with his claim against any implication on his part in Brown's raid, as he also played with double meanings for peace. He was thus for peace, Douglas maintained, but there could be no peace between one man standing on the neck of his brother and the man who was under his heel. The American announced that the slave would be free, whether by peace or by war. Douglas told his Glasgow comrades that Brown had succeeded much better by failure than he would have if he had held out till this time. Martyrdom on the gallows gave the war propagandist an unbounded way to make the old story new. Just before leaving Canada, Douglas had written a farewell message to my American readers and friends. He betrayed great anxiety and sadness in his forced exile. Neither the long experience of partings and meetings, nor the calmness borrowed from philosophy, eased his fears. But he took heart in making the most of the stern old hero awaiting execution and martyrdom. "The Christian blood of old John Brown," he declared, "will not cease to cry from the ground long after the clamors of alarm and consternation from slaveholders had ceased." Douglas announced himself glad to use the event at Harper's Ferry to assault with yet new fervor the benumbed conscience of the nation. He may have fled for his life to a temporary asylum in England, but he now had a great new story and adoring audiences that allowed him to walk by sight. Having saved himself from death on a gallows in a Virginia field, a living Douglas had work to do. Douglas's exile had landed him among friends. In March 1859, Julia Griffiths had married Henry O. Crofts, a Methodist minister and missionary who had served from 1839 to 1851 in Canada, and whom she had met in 1857. They provided a welcome landing for the newly fugitive Frederick. When Douglas came ashore in Liverpool on November 24th, he traveled immediately to Halifax, where he found my old friend Julia quite glad to see me, and what was of equal importance, her husband too. Douglas had earlier described the Reverend Crofts as an excellent anti-slavery man who had worked among fugitive slaves in Canada. They all had much in common, not least of which was still coping with the residue of Garrisonian scandal-mongering about Frederick and Julia. After Griffith's return to England in 1855, the Garrisonians, namely Parker Pillsbury, while touring, had tried to monitor her activities, believing absurdly that Douglas had dispatched Julia to raise money not only for his paper and his mortgage, but to forge rival abolition groups in Britain. Pillsbury wrote in 1856 that the two alleged lovers had been mortgaged to each other, and both to the devil. Garrisonian orthodoxy reached far beyond U.S. borders. But no such rumors deterred Griffiths in the least from her new career of organizing women's anti-slavery societies in England and Scotland, nor from writing her extraordinary public letters to Douglas's paper. By February 1859, she reported that she had succeeded in organizing 20 new anti-slavery groups among her British sisters, and in reorganizing many older ones. Griffiths was a brilliant publicist and activist, who, as a woman alone, crisscrossed England, Scotland, and Ireland, raising consciousness and money for Douglas's paper, as well as for the Rochester Ladies' anti-slavery fairs, and for supporting fugitive slaves in New York State. She was the driving force behind the Edinburgh Ladies' new anti-slavery association, and reported memberships of 31 in Wakefield and 41 in her own town of Halifax. Such heroic efforts did not go unnoticed publicly by her friend. In April 1858, Douglas wrote to the Halifax women, "I wish your society could have seen the 20 fugitives we have helped on their way to Canada during the past week. Every example leaves the system weaker." Griffith's women even sent $10 for John Brown's widow in late 1859. As Douglas hit the circuit in England and Scotland, Julia stepped in seamlessly as his manager. Her friend's presence had fostered a highly successful fundraising campaign, she reported in March 1860. Invitations poured in from all over England and Scotland, and Julia served as agent. "It has been a great pleasure to his friends," she said, "to see him once again safe in old England, and to welcome him to their firesides." During his second British sojourn, and well beyond, Douglas had many other rumors and accusations to face as well. The tales of his alleged betrayal of promises to Brown and his men refused to die, and a U.S. Senate committee spent 6 months engaged in a somewhat hapless investigation of the Harper's Ferry conspiracy. The stories about Douglas's abandonment of Brown referred back to an unconfirmed rumor that at their Detroit meeting in March 1859, Brown had accused Douglas of cowardice to his face because of his refusal to enlist in the Harper's Ferry scheme. But over time, the complaints about Douglas's role emanated largely from Brown's surviving children, Anne, Salmon, Ruth, and John Jr. In the summer of 1859, some of Brown's men, especially John Coggy, apparently felt convinced Douglas would personally join them in Maryland. In June, Coggy wrote to Douglas to congratulate him on his decision to join, and told the editor that his name was magic in recruiting other black men. According to Franklin Sanborn, a group of Philadelphia blacks wrote a letter to Douglas pledging support for his family in Rochester should he not return from the invasion of Virginia. Yet another unsubstantiated rumor had it that Douglas had escorted Shields Green to Chambersburg to join Brown's band as his own paid substitute. An interview conducted in 1909 by Catherine Mayo, Oswald Garrison Villard's research assistant on his biography of John Brown, turned up a reminiscence from a Mrs. Russell, a Bostonian who had visited Brown in his jail cell before the execution. She claimed that Brown had no fondness for Fred Douglas, and stated that his defeated plan we owe to the famous Mr. Frederick Douglas. Such claims were always much more ex post facto bitterness than reality. Someone had to be blamed for the old hero's folly, especially after he walked so gracefully to the hangman's noose to die for the nation's sins. It is a rather pointless speculation to suggest, as one scholar has done, that Douglas's opposition was detrimental to the raid. Brown himself seemed fully aware that his own faulty strategy and indecision had led to defeat. In famous letters from jail while awaiting the gallows, he wrote to his brother Jeremiah, "I am worth inconceivably more to hang than for any other purpose." And to his wife, Mary, Brown offered this agonizing self-epitaph, "I have been whipped, as the saying is, but am sure I can recover all the lost capital occasioned by that disaster, by only hanging a few moments by the neck, and feel quite determined to make the utmost possible out of a defeat." With a culture of martyrdom emerging around John Brown's body, blaming Douglas for the defeat at Harper's Ferry seems strange in retrospect. This Jesus and his glorious cross needed no Judas, and soon his cause grew vaster than even the old man might have imagined. From England, Douglas monitored the investigation conducted in the Senate by a committee chaired by James Mason of Virginia. The Mason Committee met with regularity from December 16, 1859 to June 14, 1860. Consisting of Senators Mason, Jefferson Davis of Mississippi, and G.N. Fitch of Indiana for the majority Democrats, and Senators Jacob Collamer of Vermont and James R. Doolittle of Wisconsin for the Republican minority, the hearings, with Davis serving as chief inquisitor, interrogated many witnesses to ascertain whether any subversive organizations had been involved in Brown's exploits. But during this volatile election year, the Mason Committee turned into more of a political exercise, with the Democrats seeking to identify and blame Republican congressmen as culprits, and with most Republicans striving to keep distance between themselves and Brown's radicalism. The committee interviewed Republican luminaries William H. Seward, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Henry Wilson, and John Andrew of Massachusetts, and Representative Joshua Giddings of Ohio. Correspondence from Giddings had been found in Brown's trunks after the raid. The hearings also included the questioning of two members of the group of Brown supporters known as the Secret Six, George Luther Stearns and Samuel Gridley Howe. But the Mason Committee seemed less interested in proving a legal conspiracy than in eventually putting the whole affair behind the nation before the election. Since Douglas was out of the country, the indictment against him, as well as nearly all others, was abandoned. Only four arrest warrants were issued, and those because they had refused to testify: John Brown Jr., James Redpath, Franklin B. Sanborn, and Thaddeus Hyatt. Only Hyatt was jailed for 3 months in Washington, D.C., before being released when the committee issued its reports. In the end, the Mason Committee, despite Jefferson Davis's personal ire for Seward, Giddings, and all abolitionists, chose not to delve into the reality of Brown's conspiracy. Its legal work seemed dictated more by the much-anticipated Democratic Party nominating convention to be held in Charleston, South Carolina, in April, and the Republican convention in Chicago early that summer. The Mason Committee's majority report delivered special censure for all the New England financial and military support for Brown's Kansas Crusade, as well as for abolitionists' belief in higher law doctrines. But it seemed convinced that Brown's invasion was the work of a relatively lone, deranged outlaw striving to incite servile insurrection. Hovering over the Mason Committee's deliberations was that Virginia had already created one martyr, the consequences of which had produced a toxic political environment, and it had no wish to create any more. Too much was at stake politically for all concerned in 1860 for the committee to seek anything resembling the deeper truth. Douglas was one beneficiary of an incompetent congressional inquiry into America's deepest dilemma. He never had to face the future president of the Confederacy in a Senate hearing. It would not be the last time Douglas found himself first trapped by and then offered the open opportunity to exploit his country's refusal to face its past or present. Soon, he could return to the United States, relatively comfortable knowing that he did not face arrest or execution for the crime of conspiracy in which he now declared great pride. While in England, Douglas, as usual, buried his personal anxieties in travel and lecturing. He remained on the defensive about his flight to Canada and Britain, as well as his family's fate. Douglas felt under scrutiny about his choices, as he wrote to an old Irish friend, Maria Webb. He had to escape arrest and trial in Virginia. "I could never hope to get out of that state alive," he told Webb. "If they did not kill me for being concerned with dear old Brown, they would have done so for my being Frederick Douglass." Being Frederick Douglass is what he did in England to overflow crowds and with the stirrings of controversy. Douglass appealed to the religious and national pride of his Scottish audiences. The Christianity of Scotland, he said, had no sanction for chains or slavery, whereas in the American South, the clank of the fetter might be heard along with the chime of the bell that called to prayer. Men might be seen going to prayer on one side of the street and chain gangs on the other side. In Scotland, he sang the old songs about Christian hypocrisy with new urgency. In Glasgow, in February 1860, Douglas delivered a remarkable historical lecture on how America had descended from two distinct societies, one born among the Bible-inspired believers in the Magna Carta aboard the Mayflower in 1620, and the other aboard a Dutch galley slave ship landing in Virginia in 1619. One society led to light, and the other darkness. The first brought Christ, and the other Belial, or the Old Testament conception for evil and Satan. This dichotomous simplicity gave way to a narrative of how the country had collapsed into the most trying crisis in her history, bounded by the enactments of the Fugitive Slave Act and the Dred Scott decision, which Douglas called the moral assassination of his whole race. At the same time, in Glasgow, Newcastle, and other cities, Douglas got into a nasty scrap with British Garrisonians, especially the famed George Thompson, over disunionism and the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution. Douglas plied old waters, but he seemed eager for another go at his old nemesis. Thompson responded with public rebuttals and specially published addresses denouncing Douglas's views and his harsh style. The Glasgow Emancipation Society reported that an April 3rd address in the City Hall by Thompson had been a refutation, lucid and triumphant, against the charges that F. Douglas had brought against the lecturer. But Douglas loved these public squabbles, and his well of resentments and supply of sarcasm against Garrisonians seemed bottomless. He even made a vigorous case for the potential anti-slavery power of the Republican Party in America, appropriating it to his natural rights conception of the Constitution. Although he gladly engaged in a personalized fight with Thompson over their respective readings of the Constitution, Douglas believed the time had passed for arcane argument. His Scottish audiences liked a vaguer kind of eloquence. "Slavery is essentially a dark system," he declared in Glasgow in March 1860. "All it wants is to be excluded and shut out from the light. If it can only be boxed in where there is not a single breath to fall upon it, it dreads the influence of truth." By his own circuitous route, Douglas may have landed on the central truth of why the Republican Party posed such a threat to Southern slavery. Such a political force could use parts of the Constitution, should it gain power, to bring slavery to an ultimate destruction. Douglas also faced new issues in England, as he found traction with older arguments. His own large audiences and Griffith's extraordinary labors to revive anti-slavery societies notwithstanding, the British abolition movement appeared in decline. Many in the British public had soured on the question of West Indian emancipation, arguing that it had failed, and that Africans and their descendants were proving incapable of free labor. Worse, increasingly American forms of racism that Douglas had not seen in 1846 to 47 appeared now on British streets, in theaters, and even in social discourse. A new roiling of racism in Britain disturbed him immensely. In his speech, British Racial Attitudes in Newcastle, Douglas reminisced about encountering not the slightest ill feeling toward me because of my complexion in 1846. But now, American prejudice might be found in the streets of Liverpool and in nearly all our commercial towns. He especially blamed that pestiferous nuisance, Ethiopian minstrels, who brought here the slang phrases, the contemptuous sneers, all originating in the spirit of slavery. He made it clear that he hated seeing the Negro represented in all manner of extravagances,